Hello, and welcome to another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong, and in this podcast, I speak to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. You can subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher, or Acast, like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk, and check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. There's a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. You can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Purchasing through that deal is cheaper than Amazon, and it's also a good way to directly support Turkey Book Talk. Books included on the list are written by authors who have featured on this podcast at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eşref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, The Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. To order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit the page for the offer, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can contribute as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But now on with this latest episode, in which I speak to Max Hoffman. He's Associate Director for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress, and one of the authors of a new report called Trends in Turkish Civil Society, produced in cooperation with the Istanbul Policy Center at Sabancı University and the IAI think tank in Italy. I'll put a link to it up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, so you can check it out there. The report comes amid the recent arrests of human rights activists in Turkey, including the two heads of Amnesty International, Taner Kılıç and İdil Eser. The space for civil society in the country has been shrinking steadily due to the crackdown after last year's military coup attempt, as well as the reignited conflict between the security forces and the PKK in the southeast. Since July 2016, almost 50,000 people have been arrested, 140,000 have been fired or suspended from their jobs, 1,500 civil society organisations have been closed, and over 150 media outlets have been shuttered. The general atmosphere has also deteriorated into one of grim paranoia. The report gives a pretty chilling account of this state of affairs, and also makes some recommendations about how outsiders can try and help the situation. I started by asking Max Hoffman to set out what they were trying to achieve with this report.
Well, the report is part of a project that we called Turkey 2023, and the aim was to look at how the Turkish state and society and the economy and state institutions had shifted over the last 5 years, and what would need to happen in order for the government to meet its extremely ambitious 2023 goals. And the idea was that it was so easy for analysts of Turkey and, of course, politically engaged Turks and Europeans who care about Turkey to just get caught up in the day-to-day sort of crisis politics that had taken over. And the idea was to step back and say, okay, what are the broad, long-term secular trends that are reshaping the state and society, and that will be important in determining what kind of country Turkey is in 2023. And so we focus first on the economy and the economic reforms that would be necessary to unlock a new round of economic growth and bring more women into the workforce and move into higher technology, manufacturing, things like that. And the second big focus after, of course, the intervening crisis, which was the coup attempt, which transformed the whole aim and outlook of the project. The second phase was to look at civil society. And the reason for that was because we felt that Turkish civil society had, really flourished and blossomed in the late 90s. And then, of course, through the early years of the AKP rule, that it was extremely diverse and vibrant. And that was something that was often lost in Western and European and American analyses of the situation. But that, of course, it was under tremendous pressure. And so we wanted to understand what impact civil society groups were having, what sort of restrictions they had, both in legal terms and then in de facto terms, in the way they deal with state authorities and the way they interact with society. And we felt that Turkish civil society is extremely important for a number of reasons. I mean, if you think about the big problems facing the country, whether it's youth unemployment or the integration of Syrian refugees or integrating more women in the workforce or, even, of course, course, the Kurdish conflict and the polarization around that. It's hard to imagine Turkey reaching positive outcomes on these different challenges without real engagement from civil society actors across the board. And the other big point to make is that with the high-level politics between Turkey and Europe and Turkey and the United States so polarized and so negative, in such a negative place, and so much controversy, civil society offers one of the last remaining areas where Europeans and Americans and Turks who believe that Turkey's future lies with Europe and with further integration with Europe and the West to really have an effect and to engage with Turkish actors. And so those were the main reasons sort of driving us towards this analysis of Turkish civil society.
And the research involved many conversations, interviews with civil society activists, leaders, practitioners in the field here in Turkey. And obviously, we all know that it's a pretty grim time at the moment, and you mentioned that in the report. Could you just talk a bit about the kind of mood among the people who you spoke to while doing the research?
Yeah, that's right. We tried. I mean, the report is really a synthesis of the academic research that's out there. Of course, some of our task force's own political analysis, but primarily it's conveying the things we heard from, we talked to about 40 to 50 civil society activists and leaders, and then, a number of academics who study the sector, both in Turkey and elsewhere. And the mood is, as you'd expect, fairly grim. It's happening in a context where the country was already polarized along pretty familiar fault lines, politically and socially. And then you add to the mix the extreme controversy and the high emotions resulting from the Syrian war and the resumption of the Kurdish conflict. And then, of course, the coup attempt and the profound trauma that brought with it for Turkish politics and society. And then the aftermath in which a legitimate need to bring to justice as the perpetrators has, I think most would agree, spiraled into something more, into a very wide-ranging purge. And so the big feeling among Turkish civil society leaders was just deep uncertainty. Civil society has always been somewhat limited in Turkey. There have always been taboo subjects or things, particularly surrounding the Kurdish question, that were liable to get you into trouble with state authorities or might get you into trouble with state authorities. And the feeling was that those traditional red lines were there, but that there were new restrictions and it just wasn't quite clear where the lines were. So people generally were responding to that uncertainty and the fear of potentially being labeled a terrorist or potentially being, at the least pilloried in the press as a sort of tool of a foreign power of some kind. Most people responded to that uncertainty by withdrawing. And so lots of civil society activities were kind of going underground or were adopting a very low profile in the hopes of avoiding any of that controversy in such a deeply polarized and very emotional political environment. The other almost unanimous feeling among civil society actors was sort of a lament of the fragmentation in the sector. So everybody we spoke to, whether they were religious conservative activists or humanitarians working on the Syrian refugee crisis or secularists determined to improve educational outcomes or Kurdish activists looking for greater cultural or political rights. Everybody had their own constituency and their own concerns and was advocating on behalf of that in-group's rights. But they all lamented that there were no alliances with other groups. They acknowledged that, for example, a Kurdish political activist faces many of the same restrictions and challenges as a women's rights activist from a religious conservative background, and that all of these NGOs face similar financial and legal restraints. But there were very few instances people could provide of cooperation across the kind of traditional fault lines in Turkish society. And that was something that everybody lamented and everybody wanted to address in order to increase the effectiveness of civil society and its impact. But nobody seemed to be able to get past those old fault lines and those divides, whether they're ethnic or religious or political, in the current, highly polarized context. So those were the two big points we heard from almost everyone we spoke with.
One of the things you mentioned in the report, and I really want to flag it up because it's really didn't get that much attention at the time, it's about how during the April referendum on shifting to this kind of authoritarian presidential system, the changes included this important change, and that was handing the state supervisory board prosecutorial powers over civil society organizations, and thus giving the president even more power to police them. Could you just talk a bit about how that could further tighten the screws on civil society in Turkey.
That's right. The first, in response to the specific question about the change, it's very unclear. And actually, despite all the headlines around the referendum, I think there's a real lack of clarity about how implementation will proceed. I think it's safe to assume, though, that what we'll see is the moving from a de facto situation in which power was concentrated in President Erdogan's hands to a de jure situation, really reflecting the same reality. The State Supervisory Board will be able to look into and shut down civil society groups. But that's not a big change from the state of emergency. That's just sort of enshrining these expanded powers to some extent. It's a new tool in the hands of the presidency and in the hands of the governing party. But it's really just kind of the latest example, because one of the things you realize very quickly reading the laws governing not just civil society, but particularly civil society in Turkey, is that as in many respects in Turkish life, the state is absolutely paramount, and its power over all aspects of society and political life is profound. The constitution and the penal code and the law, the various laws governing political activities, whether that's the anti-terror law, the law on demonstrations, or the laws governing associations and foundations, or, the internet laws, all of them are so vaguely written that it leaves tremendous sort of decision-making power to the discretion of state officials. And the result of that, according to most of the people we interviewed, was just very uneven implementation of the law and very political implementation of the law. So I suspect, we'll have to wait and see about, the question of how the State Supervisory Board will use these new prosecutorial powers, but it's likely to reflect the way in which the penal code or the anti-terror law is used, which is that critics of the government and particularly Kurdish political activists, to a lesser extent, secular political activists, and now, of course, to a very great extent, anybody who is seen as affiliated with the Gulen movement will face prosecution, while those state tools will not be utilized to crack down on people who are perceived as supportive of the current government. That's a real problem, this uneven implementation. But it's not just limited to civil society, as you know. This is really part of a broader, wider process of the erosion of rule of law and the independence of the judiciary. So it's a major problem. But civil society organizations, despite almost always having some sort of legal risk or legal uncertainty hanging over their head because of how vague the laws are, they still find room to operate, and they still do a tremendous amount of good. So it's a very gloomy picture at times, but it's important to remember that despite that, there are tens of thousands of civil society activists and Turkish citizens trying to improve outcomes along a range of issues.
What about the question of like GONGOs or government supported civil society organizations? Because Turkey's always had this problem, but it seems to me that the problem is becoming just ever more acute, and there are all kinds of acronym groups popping up that are basically kind of organically linked to the AKP or Erdogan. And the idea is, of course, to give a kind of veneer of external validation for various government policies. And the practical effect, in many ways, is to kind of push out genuine civil society groups. I wonder if you could just talk a bit about this factor as well. How is that being reflected on the ground? It seems like it's just another way that the government's been centralizing control in recent years.
That's right. This is a really important trend that I think needs more research, and particularly more reliable research from Turks, who just because of language and social reasons and knowledge of the system and of society will be able to understand this better than any outside in researchers. But it's a big trend, and one of the big questions really after the break between the AKP and the Gulen movement, or most of the AKP and the Gulen movement back in 2013. Or even before that, was they're very uncomfortable with this history now. But the fact is that the Gulen movement and its various civil society and business arms functioned to a large extent as the civil society wing of the AKP for many years. And that gave tremendous power over public discourse, over over academic developments and business realm to the government. And the loss of that civil society wing has perhaps harmed the AKP's sort of social footprint, and it it's made it a more insular party, and it's certainly affected its ability to reach out and affect the conversation internationally and in capitals in Europe and in Washington. So the question of how they would try and replace those civil society groups and that sort of social wing to the party is an open one. And their efforts have focused, as you mentioned, around a handful of groups, including several linked to Erdogan's children. But I think it's still very much an open question. I don't think any of them have reached the level of effectiveness of what really the Gulen movement managed to build. It's nowhere near as broad-based because it's not based on this network of schools like Gulen was, which gave it tremendous influence. You know, the other thing is that because they are seen as so closely affiliated with the party, with the AKP, that is, they have very limited ability to reach out to new constituencies. And so while they may be an effective mode of distributing patronage and, you know, essentially exchanging access and a higher public profile in exchange for sort of a civil society stamp of approval, if you will, they really can't broaden the AKP's constituency. So that's a major challenge. They also, at the local municipal levels, there was a lot of anecdotal accounts of municipalities supporting NGOs with a socially conservative or religious conservative bent to try and do two things, to try and increase the political footprint of the party and also to try and ease the strain on government by providing these sort of extra governmental social services. That's, I think, one of the areas that really deserves more research. And then at the national level, one of the things that the government can do is through the tax code and through the either offering or holding back tax-exempt status for NGOs, they can have a big impact on those NGOs' effectiveness and their reach. So, for example, an organization like IHH, which is, you know, one of the most high-profile examples, with tax-exempt status, they can launch fundraising appeals without prior notification to the government. Which means they can send text message, you know, fundraising campaigns on a whim if there is some sort of desire, some sort of disaster, some political event, or some social event that they can tie that fundraising effort into. That gives them huge power. And the tax-exempt status is, by some accounts, highly political determination made by the government. So across the board, there are these kind of fragmented efforts to expand the AKP's civil society presence and build these, as you called them, gongos. It's really hard to determine how effective that is, though. And it's an area where we need to do more research.
The report spends a lot of time talking about also what outsiders can do to try and engage Turkish civil society at this tough time. What kind of conclusions did you draw on that count?
Well, the EU, of course, is by far the dominant actor here in terms of external support. The US offers very little. There is a fair amount of religious charity and some charitable giving from the Gulf along religious lines, but really the EU is the dominant player. And it's been a driving force. It was a driving force behind the early reform years of the AKP government, and it drove in large part this explosion of civil society activity in the last two decades. One of the big conclusions in the report is that, of course, the EU cannot build relations with Turkish society completely absent the approval of the Turkish government. You know, these programs have to, of course, abide by the laws of Turkey. The government, as I said, the state has a number of very powerful tools to limit their activities if they sort of get crosswise with the government. But with the high-level political relations in such a bad place, there was broad consensus that the EU should reinvest in civil society, that they should, in fact, redirect some of the pre-accession funding from being routed through Turkish state institutions, which at the moment are in chaos and are, you know, highly politicized in ways that are often contradictory to the EU's normative, you know, goals of democracy promotion and checks and balances and openness. And so redirecting some of those pre-accession funds or more of those pre-accession funds to civil society actors could be an effective response. But talking with Turkish civil society leaders, there's also a strong feeling that the EU has supported only, you know, a narrow subset of Turkish society. Generally, the secular, Western-oriented, urban, you know, basically urban elites. And there was a feeling that the same sorts of organizations always got EU funding. So there is a need to increase the EU engagement, but also broaden the social base of that engagement to include, frankly, explicitly members of the AKP's constituency, so particularly religious conservatives, but also expand outside of the major cities. And that's going to be hard to do because there's such suspicion among the AKP's constituents towards the EU, particularly now. But it's really important. And if there is an effort to perhaps even advertise outside the traditional sectors of society that look to the EU for support, and if there's an effort to direct aid towards initiatives that speak to Turkish citizens' primary concerns, which remain socioeconomic despite the political polarization, that could be successful. You know, the other thing to remember, though, is that, you know, this is not sort of a question of giving in to Turkish government pressure. The EU has to continue supporting disadvantaged groups and groups devoted to political monitoring and checks and balances, because those groups, and Kurdish actors also, because those groups remain under the most pressure. And those voices are crucial to maintaining the muscle memory that could potentially increase Turkish-European integration when the political climate at the high level improves, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's also important to note that we often hear, you know, about billions of euros going from the EU to Turkey over the years. But already, of course, a lot of EU aid has been going directly to civil society groups, sort of independent of the Turkish government.
Yeah, and the EU has taken some very good steps in the last round of funding beginning in 2014 to make it easier for small organizations and even individual activists to secure EU funding by loosening the reporting restrictions, the reporting requirements. And you can essentially get funded as a Turkish citizen, as basically a citizen activist. You can secure EU funding to pursue activities, you know, that serve EU goals, whether that's, you know, environmental protection or the, you know, minority rights or any of the EU various, or also, you know, monitoring checks and balances or monitoring state activities. Those are all things that individual activists can secure funding to pursue. And really, you don't even need the formal status of a civil society organization. The problem then is, under Turkish law, your rights are very limited. You can't, you know, you can have your personal bank account, but then you're really merging your public and personal lives in a way that brings a whole new set of legal risks. But you can't open a bank account or launch a fundraising appeal within Turkey without registering under the associations or foundations law. So the EU funding has definitely taken some important steps to broaden access and to make it easier to secure and maintain. And that's very good and should be continued. But again, it's a matter of awareness. I mean, only very Western-oriented, politically engaged urban elites, for the most part, are even aware of these programs. And so that's one of the big challenges in sort of improving the organic connections between Turkish civil society and Europe.
Also, I think there's this recommendation for support for civil society. But I wonder as well, in the current atmosphere, we've been seeing all kinds of stuff just in, you know, you look at the headlines on the front pages of the pro-government press, how there's a kind of linking of foreign-linked NGOs, a kind of characterization of them as like fifth columns or mm-hmm. proxies for dark outside powers. I wonder if, you know, increasing support, there's a kind of catch-22 situation where, of course, it's necessary, but at the same time, increasing that support is probably going to provoke this kind of response by this very paranoid government at the moment.
You're right. And that's one of the central, you know, that's the central paradox of the EU's engagement with Turkish civil society. The feeling of most civil society activists we spoke to was that, yes, you know, foreign funding is sort of there are two sides to that coin. Of course, you risk being labeled, as you mentioned, you know, some sort of servant of a foreign power or a tool of the imperialists or any of the various fairly long standing insults that can be thrown the way of people who engage with foreigners in a very nationalistic environment. But equally, that outside support allows groups to operate and provides a measure of independence and just capacity. I mean, there's so little charitable giving and giving to civil society groups or funding for civil society groups within Turkey that many of these groups have to make that compromise. And the way they try and insulate against those accusations of sort of falling under the influence of foreign powers or anything like that is by being as transparent as possible on the one hand, and also by trying to engage with as wide an array of Turkish domestic actors and sort of social constituencies as possible. And they used to also be able to engage in a cooperative fashion with the state and, well, with the AKP, I should say. That's become less frequent as the government has become more paranoid and more hostile to foreigners. And also as the AKP's electoral needs have shifted, you know, this need to shore up the nationalist constituency is not helping and things. So there are two sides to the coin, but the most vulnerable parts of Turkish society, in particular, of course, Kurdish activists and minority rights groups and LGBTQ groups and all of those various constituencies, they're under such pressure that without EU support, it's hard to imagine they'd be in a better place, despite the difficulties it can bring.
Do you think there's any prospect of the government moving to kind of formally limit NGO activity in Turkey? I'm thinking of the example, I think, from a couple of years in Russia, where the Kremlin introduced laws basically severely restricting space for foreign-linked NGOs to raise money. Thinking about the current atmosphere in Turkey, it wouldn't surprise me if something like that emerged in the coming months and years.
It certainly is a big concern. I mean, there's been a wave of NGO laws severely restricting their activities around the world in the last few years. You know, you mentioned Russia, also China, and there are several instances in Eastern Europe as well of efforts to restrict those activities. Of course, we'll have to see. But I think it would probably take, this is just a speculation, but I think it would probably take some sort of major controversy, new major controversy involving a civil society group, some sort of prompt, I believe. The reason for that is the state and the governing party already have really all the tools they need to control civil society activity as it is. That I mentioned the tax code, they can control a lot of charitable giving through the tax code. The law on associations and foundations and the penal code and the anti-terror law all contain these very vague clauses about activities contrary to, you know, the nature of the Turkish state or offensive to the Turkish state. That can really be interpreted however you want. And however local authorities and local prosecutors determine, you know, whatever they determine that to mean. Then in terms of internet activities, they can, you know, severely restrict access to certain URLs, to websites. They can block Twitter users. And of course, they can also use blanket bans to these platforms. And then in terms of organization, they have really wide-ranging powers. In order to, you know, hold a rally or a demonstration or any sort of public gathering, you have to secure permission from the local governing authorities. That includes listing the names and addresses of and contact details of the organizers and assuming personal liability as the organizer for anything that might happen at that rally. So, you know, of course, also under the state of emergency, the police have wide-ranging powers to prevent any sort of public gathering or public demonstration. So they have pretty ample powers now, and I'm not sure there's a pressing need for the state to widen those authorities, but it wouldn't surprise me, particularly as the opposition parties begin to shift. Well, I guess the CHP, really, the HDP has done this for some time, but begin to shift into more sort of popular street politics and demonstrations and these sorts of mass political gestures, which clearly worry the AKP at some level.
It's a bit of a tangent, but I guess while we're on the subject, I saw the other day that, again, in Russia, they're set to outlaw the use of VPNs, basically stopping Russians from viewing banned websites. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of worried now that that's going to inspire the Turkish government to do the same. It never really crossed my mind before, but of course, there are thousands of websites banned in Turkey that people access every day anyway through the use of VPNs, including, of course, Wikipedia, which is still banned. I just wonder, I mean, again, it's speculation, but I'm kind of fearing that may happen here as well.
Yeah, it's, I mean, China also recently made the move. And unfortunately, when it comes to internet regulation and censorship, the Turkish government has sort of been following in the footsteps of Russia and China, just without the sorts of capabilities that those two governments have. So I think they would like to more closely control online activities. And it's whether the state has the capacity to do so, you know, especially in the wake of the coup attempt and then the subsequent sort of extreme fragmentation of the state and its various bodies and institutions. So it's certainly something to watch. It would not shock me. You know, incidentally, we published a report last year on internet use and censorship. And yeah, I mean, it's a very worrying trend. And it shouldn't be surprising when we look at the overall political trajectory. But you know, I guess weighing on the other side of the scales is the fact that it's primarily a kind of an urban elite phenomenon when you talk about VPNs, and most Turks continue to get their news from television, which is very effectively controlled by the government. So while they maybe like total control, they have enough to secure their political goals and to secure their constituency. So we'll see. It's a matter of capacity, and with so many extreme challenges to the state and to state security at the moment, they might just not have the capacity to do it.
That was Max Hoffman. Thank you very much to him. Remember, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and directly supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. You can also support this podcast via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan-Marcus Vomo, Steve Bryant, Aaron Ataman, and Andrew McDowell. Remember to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. And email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until we meet again in a couple of weeks, thanks once again for listening.